This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I've been a huge fan of Rosalind's work. Her earliest work, I think in the 90s, and just was thrilled to be invited to talk about this installation work, because it's not only, the subject matter is not only close to my heart, but the experimental way in which Rosalind plays with different elements and incorporates different kinds of films into telling a story in the service of anthropology, but in the service of so much more. I just think this is a wonderful, wonderful installation. And installations are not altogether new in anthropology, but they are pretty novel. And I think, I'm hoping I'm right in saying that Rosalind had to do a lot of inventing in order to create this particular installation. It's not like you started out with a map. You had to figure out what the elements that you wanted to use and how you wanted to tell your story.
Many stories, really. I mean, it is true. And, you know, every installation has to accommodate itself to a particular space, and this is a lovely space because it allows for a movement that can mimic or that can move you towards a certain encounter. But I originally started the film work for this project, making a relatively straight documentary. And that documentary was motivated by a desire to give people, the people who are addressing you through these works, an opportunity to address you, but also a form in which they could recognize themselves. And there were lots about that project that film is now in the last stages of post, that were satisfying, that allowed for certain narratives to find their form. But there were lots of things that I felt I couldn't do in that. Limits, time limits, the structures of narrative limits that led me to want to try these other forms so that what couldn't be satisfied in a straight documentary form might find a way to enter the world and be seen and heard. And so I think of this as, you know, the first video in the first room is a kind of like moving image. It's not a film in the same way as a narrative documentary. It's not even a film in the way the other pieces are. It's a moving image, an ambient piece that's intended to move you places. And I guess that would be the kind of conception of the installation I had in some way as a using of the architectural space to move you narratively and conceptually toward these people, actually.
Well, it's almost like we enter from the outside, as we actually literally do. We walk in, we see someone walking on a road, we see the outside, we come into another room, we are enticed by the music, we see other images, other videos, and then we go into the mines in that room, although we see mining in this video as well. So it's as if you kind of simulate the journey in a way by giving us bits of information. So by the time we arrive at the mines, we know a little bit more about where we're going.
Yeah. And these worlds are simultaneous. The above-ground world exists on a surface that is simultaneous with the world underground. And in some ways, you encounter both the origins of this journey, the fantasies of, you know, Igoli, of this great city of wealth and opportunity. And you move along that journey, which is, you know, concocted out of, it's a montage of various pieces, but in these more fragmentary narratives in this room, you also, in some ways, encounter the consequences of both of that phantasmatic journey, the set of desires and hopes, and, you know, an accident, a shooting, a hope for education, those kinds of things. So you're both before and after the mines in these two rooms before you, as you say, hit this simulation of an underground space. Let's distant simulation.
Well, this room functions as a way of presenting individuals and individual portraits, because you are allowed to engage with them more closely. There are conversations that are subtitled. How did you choose the people you wanted to focus on in this part of the installation?
That's an interesting question. I mean, how did I choose them? In some ways, I think they chose me. When I started this project, having worked in this area for two decades, I indicated that I'd be willing to work on a film with people if they were interested. I made myself available. I didn't seek anyone out. I said, I will be here. If you're interested, you come and see me. And indeed, over several days and weeks, people came, and they had great ambitions to tell their stories. But I got deeply entangled in the lives of some individuals. This family whom you encounter on that video there, one of those men is the man who actually films underground. That's his wife and his child. But there are also things in here that are here because they couldn't fit in any other way, in any other place in this imagined filmic account, which is addressed both to a South African audience and to an international audience, and addressed differently to those audiences. So a piece about an accident didn't ultimately make it into the film because indeed those were not individuals who were at the center of the narrative. But that experience of an accident, that experience of bodily destruction, that experience of being dependent on your friends and colleagues to take you out, but not being able to access to the state, not being able to access ambulatory care or police or those kinds of things. I wanted a place in which we all who are implicated in the world that Gold made to listen to those people. And the method for all of these, as you'll see, is one in which people are interviewing each other. I'm not interviewing them. We have spent days talking about issues, and then they select the things that they feel are most important, conduct their own interviews, and we are present to receive that conversation, which I'm trying to act a bit as a medium who allows for this address to you and to others, which is partly dependent on me and is partly independent of me. My hope is that you encounter those as conversations that have a truth quite separately from my filmic ambitions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, their stories really come through, and it seems as if they are, they're both, you see them telling their stories the way they want to tell their stories. Although there is someone asking questions, and are you saying the person asking the questions is also, say, a friend or someone from the community?
Yes. In this case, a cousin.
Okay.
In this case, someone, a long-term community member who acts as the kind of anchor of this community of undocumented migrants who are moving between Lesotho, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. In each case, people are interviewed by people with whom they've had long relationships.
Okay. Yeah. And in the video in the corner, Dreams of Democracy?
Dreaming Democracy, yes.
Dreaming Democracy. That's more of a conversation among people. Among men.
Yeah.
Did you set that up, or how did it work that you sort of stumbled onto this conversation, and can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah. That conversation is enormously important to me, and I hope it's enormously interesting to everyone. In some ways, it's an absolutely ordinary conversation. People in this world, this destituted world, talk about politics with such intelligence and acuity and verve all the time. This is, you know, this conversation could have been on any given day, to be honest. And indeed, you know, when I go back, the first question I get is, how did Trump get elected? Who voted for whom? What is this idiot thing that you have, this electoral college? What is, you know? So, I mean, this is a kind of very active engagement, and I feel it's really important for people to recognize that level and intensity of political discourse. In that case, these works are produced over a period of about 3 years. And each couple of months I go back, both to keep up with people with whom I work and whom I know. And sometimes I film, often I don't, mostly I don't. But the initial filming, I thought we're going to finish in 6 months. And things happened. There was an accident. Then one person was shot. Then another person was shot. Then yet another person was shot. And I felt, no, these lives continue. We have to find a way to account for that continuing nature. After the expulsion of Mugabe, the final fall of Mugabe, I felt like, okay, this is going to change this world. Given that most of the migrants whom you encounter in these works are Zimbabweans who have come to South Africa undocumented in pursuit of labor. They're following the same paths that miners have always followed, you know, for at least for 120 years, but now illegalized and now not recruited by formal mines. I thought we need to talk about what happened, you know. So indeed, I did convene my friends and said, you know, let's talk. You know, what's going on? Well, I didn't expect this conversation, which went on for 5 hours. And in the straight documentary, We Are Zama Zama, it's a 4.5 minute coda. But what a violence to the fullness of that conversation. Yes, unfortunately, one has to make these kinds of decisions in certain straight documentary forms. But the fullness seemed to merit us listening for a while, being with them for a while, as they're talking through all of that. So one camera only, one sound person. We are a crew of three. It's totally guerrilla filmmaking because that world requires mobility. We just stayed with them, and as I said, in all of the methods are always that they are interviewing or conversing with each other. We are filming nonstop. We go back and translate after the fact every moment, then edit on that basis. And my editor Pascal Plutz-Trumel, you know, works with me to try and produce something that has a certain coherence.
So backtracking a little bit, because we jumped right in.
Sorry.
For those of you who don't know, for the audience members who don't know about the Zama Zama project, can you start by defining Zama Zama? And can you tell us a little bit about how long you've worked there and what your what various forms your research is being, the results of your research are manifesting?
Yeah. You know, I started, as I said, more than 20 years ago. I was working around the formal mines, deepest mines in the world, 4 kilometers deep. Most of those mines are beginning to close now. That means there's a retraction in labor. It means the closure but non-sealing of these shafts, and as you see in some of these works, it also means the destruction of the physical spaces of those mines. In many cases, the individual buildings were intentionally destroyed in a vindictive act on the part of the mining companies for non-payment of rents. And this process began in the late 80s, early 90s. These particular mines closed around 1994. The Zama Zama project is an attempt to account for the afterlives of this economy, which was, you know, the center of the South African imaginary, although it hasn't, you know, not since 1974 has the gold industry been the center of the South African economy. But it's remained in people's minds as the source of wealth and possibility. The Zama Zama project has as its object this thing, Zama Zama. Zama means to try in isiZulu and in many of the other Bantu languages of the area. Zama Zama is a reduplicative that means to keep on trying. It also means to gamble, and it is the term given to these kind of informal miners who go deep underground. So not just people who work on the surface in, you know, gathering, you know, reprocessing slime dams or things like that. Zama Zama refers to those people who actually go into these old mines, who are descending with no technology, without dewatering, without ventilation or oxygenation, without electricity. And they will spend anywhere from 3 days to 6 months underground at a time. Now, the people with whom I work are primarily people who work relatively independently, so they are not part of kind of organized crime syndicates or anything. They are mostly self, as they understand themselves, autonomous, free, self-employed people. And that there is, of course, gangsterism and other kinds of activity, so they're staying underground for about 3 to 7 days at a time. You can imagine if you stay underground for 6 months, this is a big operation that's requiring supply chains of a complicated sort, and that's more on the organized crime side.
Wow.
There are thousands of such people now in South Africa and throughout Southern Africa who live, you could say, as the rag pickers.
The amount of gold that they seem to get in one effort seems so tiny. But so if they've been down there for 3 days, about how much gold do they come back with?
I think somewhere you see this little nugget. This might be 4 days' work. People can live on it, or they wouldn't be doing it. If they're lucky, they might make 2,000-3,000 rand a month. That would be, you know, something less, so a couple of hundred dollars worth. An enormous strike. One of these young men strikes it rich, and he gets 4,500 rand worth of gold. That's $300, and was very pleased to say that he could survive for 3 months on that. So they're small amounts, very small amounts, and. You know, as with all gambling, one of the miners says, you know, Zama Zama is like gambling, but the better part of gambling. Sometimes you may get 300, sometimes you may get 200, sometimes you may get 1,000. If you're lucky, you can make a living. And this notion of luck, of course, in all gambling worlds, you know, and Walter Benjamin said this so beautifully, right? The end of, you know, industrial capitalism gives us the gambler and the rag picker and the flaneur. Not so much flannery here, but these two figures are somehow congealed in one being in this. And the term is not used so much for women,
okay.
Although they are very present here. They are doing all the above ground manual labor of crushing rock to prepare it for sluicing. So they are not named as such, but in fact their work is just as dangerous, just as demanding, and much more constant.
Well, clearly in the interview you have with the woman, Sarah, mm-hmm. who is there with her child, you can tell that even if she's not down in the mine, every incident within the mine is going to affect her life.
Right.
It's as if she's kind of waiting by the telephone, although there's no telephone.
Cell phone, yeah.
Yeah.
She says an amazing thing. She says when an accident occurred underground, she went with other women to the shaft opening, and she was shocked. Even though her husband had worked under there for 9 years, she had never seen even the opening to a mine. And she said, "I was ashamed." And it's a shocking thing, really, to hear her say of this. I was ashamed that we have been reduced to this. And sometimes when relations are called upon, when an accident occurs, that I would actually say that is the most common, beyond horror, shame is the most common sentiment.
Wow.
Along with the bravado, this sensation that people have been forced to do what no reasonable human being should do is very powerful.
So when I was watching, there's so many different ways to watch this material. I watch them at home on my laptop in a particular order. And two of the films, I think Above Ground Below.
Below Ground Above.
below
okay,
ground
it's an
above.
Awkward title. It seemed like a good idea.
The titles are very elusive and elusive. And Thresholds of the Visible World, you see elements of the mine and you wonder, did Rosalind go down there? And how did you pay a camera person to go down there? And each of the films has sort of a different experience of the mine, but it seems like it's the same trip, right? So with this, the mining, which you see right behind me, it's intercut with the singing of religious people in the streets, and these are photographs of those people. And it's as if, as the people go down into the mine, they get a much-needed blessing. So it's a kind of, and then the singing kind of dies out as they get deeper and deeper. But it's a kind of
I'm not using the word in a negative sense, but it's manipulated. It's edited.
It's totally
by you to create a certain effect. Mm-hmm. Then, which I'll ask you to talk about, then you have to tell me again.
Below ground, above.
Below ground, above.
This title is obviously not working. I must rethink this.
Well, I even took a note. Below ground, above. It's almost like observational film, which means kind of that fly on the wall documentary where you're watching people, only it's not subtitled. So you get another angle in a way, or another version of the story. So do you want to talk about those two techniques and then we'll talk about the third version?
Okay. This was actually the last edited of them all.
Okay.
That one was the Below Ground Above was the first edited. And yes, indeed. So that is the work of three different camera people, each of whom has quite a distinct, actually, aesthetic language. One of the young men, a guy named Bekani, the word means to look, Rajas Bekani Mumpande, he is filming as a minor films. He is concerned with the surfaces of the rock. Every time he looks, his camera is attaching itself to the surfaces of the rock. And even when we look at the footage together afterwards, he's saying, oh man, there's a vein there. I should have stopped. We should have. I mean, it's really extraordinary.
So the miners, put the camera on the miners?
Are, all of these, so yes, I did go down. Yes, I did go down with my cameraman, Ibrahim Haji, wonderful South African cinematographer. And we did not go all that far down. I have been to both formal mines and informal mines, and I am not up to that physically, nor probably psychically. I wouldn't also want to be a burden to other people who would have to look after me, and women are not wanted underground. So all of those factors played a role. Mm-hmm. But I will just, flat out, if you watch those men cross those planks, I would not do that. That kind of heroic anthropology has no interest to me. And when I first saw that footage, I was shocked and horrified. I had not grasped the fullness of the risks they were taking. I mean, I really took my breath away. Another of the young men produces all the solitudes. He takes his camera and leaves everyone else all the time. So the end sequences you'll see are very much the language of a man named Darren Munenge. And the very social moments are almost all the work of another young man, Prosper Ntuba, and that's what he is interested in. But these, of course, have been edited together. So yes, I wanted it to be, and indeed in some important way, I wanted all of these works to bespeak the point of view of these miners. I gave them body harnesses, hoping they would use that so that they would keep their hands free. They chose not to do that. They wanted their cameras in their hands. They did not only want their bodily point of view, they wanted their intellectual point of view, they wanted their aesthetic point of view to be realized, and that's what they have done in this work. 6 hours of footage, so this is a very tightly edited piece, which I think it's fair to say is deeply manipulated. The soundtrack is external. I wanted it to communicate this tension between what was once an industrial, electrified world, so that a lot of the external sound has this kind of electronic quality, and just the brute exposure and the remanualization of that world. So there's also just a lot of O-tone, and they are coming in and out at different moments. It has all been subtitled, but because the purpose of that is to get people to have a sensory encounter with the extremity that these miners are enduring.
Mm-hmm.
I've suppressed that. Now, you can still hear them speak, and if you understand those languages, you can still hear them joke and address each other in 5 different languages. But without the subtitling for most of us, that doesn't work. I did show this work in Berlin, where there were a number of young South African men, and they did understand it. And that was quite remarkable in the absence of the subtitles for these two audiences to be hearing so differently that work. Both it is both POV oriented and, as you say, quite manipulated, which is different than this kind of conceptual edit, which is producing a relationship between the aspiration to the transcendental on the surface level and the consequences of that or the forms of it, that this piece separates at some point, so that when you think you might have a reconciliation between the singing of hymns and the making of offerings underground and the church service above ground, the narrative desire for reconciliation is broken. So after this match is lit and the sulfur released, you could say it's just descent after that. This is, so to a very strong extent, this is my edit or my conceptualization of the, I suppose, the lure, the seduction of the metaphysical narratives, including the metaphysical narrative that makes gold the signifier of a transcendental value, especially, in fact, that narrative, that is somehow not matched by and irreconcilable with the real mortal exposures that people endure. I don't know if that's getting us there.
That's wonderful. So before we get to the last, what I call the last film, because it was the last, one of the last ones I saw, what I wanted to do is commend you for presenting, as you say, different forms of telling stories, which is possible in, or more possible in, an installation for different kinds of viewers. You know, we're all different kinds of learners. Some of us are more visual, some of us are less visual, some of us absolutely have to have the words and the subtitles and all of the label text. And then some of us are more experiential learners, and it's I like the removal of the subtitles because it took away the distraction of words and the task of reading from me, so that I could actually really catch all these various kinds of details of the journey down into the mines.
I think that's really, you know, I've also written a lot about this, and you can do different things in written forms than you can do in cinematic forms, and different things in moving image forms than in still forms, and so forth. And yes, in an installation, people can drop in and listen at any given moment. You don't know where you're going to enter the sequence. Where are we in that loop? You can stay for a while. You can leave as you like, whereas in a kind of straight, you know, narrative documentary, you know, you're trying to hold everyone's attention on one surface for whatever, 75 minutes, 90 minutes or so. If it works, it allows the audience to generate questions.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, you walk right by. This is the complication of an installation, but also I think the great opportunity for an installation that you can, I don't know, there's a couple of hours worth of video in here, and the images are intended both to give you a place to rest and to concentrate attention in particular ways, and to work in relationship to the image tracks that are more mobile. I guess I don't know if that works for everyone or in different ways, perhaps. I mean, you'll have to tell me, I guess.
Well, it's interesting because you cede a certain amount of control. Like, you are generous with your audience, to me. You're not telling them absolutely you must watch this shot, watch that shot, and follow the story I'm trying to tell you. You're allowing an audience to pick and choose and create the narrative structure that they want to create from the elements that you present. And I think it's not always easy to do that, right?
I mean, I would want, and I think this would be a task for, I think for many projects that are geared towards the documentation and the address to people who live lives very different from those of the audience here in places that are afflicted by various kinds of violence, that the task would be to make clear that these lives are independent of ours. That is, they have an autonomy and existence that precedes and exceeds our being present to them, even in this mediated way. and that one should feel in some ways called by that, you know, that you would want people to feel like they should listen, but also that, you know, you leave and it's going to keep going, you know. I'm trying to make that relationship somehow palpable. That sense that those lives persist, that they have their autonomy, they don't depend on me for their existence, nor does the fact of this videographic work accord it an existence that it doesn't have in my absence. But that, I mean, this is an illusion, no doubt, but it's also an ethically interesting illusion that that a work could both testify to the autonomous existence of other worlds and make you conscious of an address coming from it.
Mm-hmm.
Which depends on this kind of experience of having film, of having... Because the people who are involved in this film really want to address people in a room like this and elsewhere. They are speaking beyond their world in a very specific effort to solicit attention, to persuade you of certain things, to teach you different things. They're making claims on the South African public sphere. They're making claims for state recognition, but they're also making claims for other kinds of recognition, whether it's the aspiration for celebrity or whether it's just the aspiration for affirmation.
Well, I think that becomes clear in A Film Is Being Made, mm-hmm. which is, in anthropology, we call it a reflexive film of sorts. It's reflexive because it reveals the process of filmmaking. In it, it sort of fills in some of the gaps left by the other two films about the mining. You hear that, in fact, I think one of the things that happens in the beginning of this film is there's a ritual before they go down into the mine. And the camera is tilted in such a way that you can't actually see everything they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So you think, what are they doing? And if you know anthropology, you think, well, maybe it's a ritual. But you hear in A Film Is Being Made, yes, one of the miners says, I managed to film the ritual, or I filmed the ritual. So you get certain behind-the-scenes information because all of the dialogue is translated. And as the men go down into the mine, they are talking about the filmmaking process, what to get, telling each other to stay out of the way of the camera. Some of them saying, don't worry, the white people are going to edit this out. There's a certain amount of confidence in your presenting them in a good light, I hear, and a certain amount of confidence that this is going to be seen, right? You're talking about their relative invisibility, but they're committing a lot. As you say, they were told, you gave them the GoPro cameras and attached them to their bodies, and it's dangerous not to keep the camera that way, but they wanted to get better shots, they wanted to film what they wanted to film, so they unhooked the cameras and used them in their hands. Can you talk about your process of working through with these people, how you talk to them about filming themselves? And I think we have to remember that in this age of media, the people are talking about WhatsApp and the internet, they know what video looks like. So it's not like some of the early experiments in anthropology of giving people who don't know what a camera is a camera. These people do know what a camera is, but it involved a process of your talking to them, and I'd like to know what did you tell them?
We talked for several days. They tried out wearing the cameras. They looked at what footage looks like on those cameras. These cameras did have monitors, so they could indeed see what they were generating. I did not give classes on film language or anything like this. I mean, basically, my commitment was that they, and I think I've said this before, that they simply think of their entire existence underground as worthy of being filmed, you know, not wait for the climax, not wait for the dynamite, not wait for the, you know, the moments that are more spectacular. But if you are sleeping and eating and defecating and telling stories of home and joking, that's worthy, and indeed as worthy as anything else. Their favorite parts to watch are the meal scenes, and what they enjoy most is to hear themselves in like really intense verbal repartee, you know. A good one-liner is everything. There's a moment in this film where someone who doesn't speak the language of these three young men, they are Chitonga speakers from northern Zimbabwe, Ndebele speaker hears them and says, oh, you know, and he imitates them all the time. Mm. He's heard one line and it's an obscenity, so every time he's in their presence, he repeats this obscenity. And finally, Bagani says to him, do you have any idea what you are saying? He says, yes, I know this language. I know this Tonga language. And he says, I could kill you with words and you wouldn't even know it. And that hearing himself say that, I could kill you with words and you wouldn't even know it, this is for him an enormously pleasurable thing. So there, but as you say, I mean, you can see that they know. They have a concept of what is documentary. At one point, some guy is saying, it's going to be like this. There's going to be a white person talking. There's going to be a talking head. It's going to be, show the action, do the interview. Show the action, do the interview. Yes, you shouldn't show the camera. They have in the early days of underground, or the early hours, they fight over whether one should actually see the camera in the frame. They are producing an incredibly complex language. Knowing what documentary looks like, of course, doesn't mean you know how to make it.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that you know how to set up reverse shots. It doesn't mean that you know really anything about how to position it, but they do. They know it, and they also produce a much more refined language as time goes on. As they're watching what they've got, they are also measuring the time. They're underground for days. They've got, you know, each of them has, say, 3 hours of battery life on that camera. They are calculating which camera, how much time, you know, what is the arc of our activity. And they're faking things. They're also not faking things. That is dynamite being set off. They are also trying to bring up gold. And this strange line, this very porous line, between a performance and a documentation of a lived existence shifts in the course of these days, and who could know actually where that line is, where someone is performing themselves, and where indeed they're performing for me, which they are, and where they're performing for you, and where they're performing for the cops. One of their strong ambitions is to use this technology to record the abuses to which they're subject by the police who are taking bribes, and by the buyers who are not paying them what they deserve, and so forth. So they have a straight, you know, a really straight, strong commitment to the testimonial function of the camera, that it can do work in almost in a kind of juridical fashion. It's going to generate evidence. And they have a sense of it as a medium of self-theatricalization and self-heroization. And they have a sense that they're producing a different narrative for their lives. That if they could learn these skills, if they could somehow, that this could change their world.
It also seems like if somebody says something about his family being able to see it.
That's right, yeah.
You were talking about Sarah going to the mine.
Right.
Of course she doesn't know what's down there.
Right.
And it's a way in which they can share their experiences.
Yeah, this one guy says he's going to show it to his kids. You know, in the old days, he says at the age of 28, you know, we didn't have to worry about this. We didn't have to worry about where we got food. Now we are playing in the mines. We'll show it to our kids. They won't believe it. So it is, I mean, it's functioning in many ways, in old-fashioned kind of documentary fashion, as I said, as evidence, as a revelation of what otherwise cannot be seen. And it's also reconfirming the narratives that are coming to them from elsewhere. And there's a strong sense of a white gaze, too, as a source of authority and legitimacy, recognition.
Yeah.
Amplification. They feel in some ways that I'm a medium for them. That is to say, it can make their speech travel beyond the space of this small world. And one of the places they want it to travel is into the, as I said, the South African public sphere, where as undocumented migrants, they are often the object of extreme xenophobic hostility, violence and exclusion. And there is a movement, even on the part of brave movement on the part of some undocumented migrants, who call for the decriminalization of this activity. It's a very dangerous thing to make that claim in a place where you don't have the right to live or what have you. But there is some energy in that direction.
In Below Ground Above, we see a number of drone shots. Mm. And I wanted to talk about that because in the mining film, the films that are primarily about going into the mines, we have the cameras attached to bodies or being handheld to go underground and reveal to us the barely visible or rarely visible. And I was very interested in your use of drone shots. And as an anthropologist, drone shots are interesting because they're almost analogous to the omniscient viewer, because it's a perspective. It's like the white narrator that these men expected to narrate the film. It's a perspective that is known because the person almost is in the position of God, in a way, knowing everything by narrating a story, or in the case of the drone, by having this visual perspective from above that no human or few humans would actually have unless you were in an airplane or something like that. And so you use the drone in a way to reveal other things that are invisible. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, there are lots of purists, and I'm totally sympathetic with them, who say never a drone. You know, this is really cheating. it can do narrative work. I mean, you've said it. I mean, there are things there is a level of environmental destruction that even as you're driving by, right by falling buildings or the mere outlines of what was once a house in a mine compound, even as you drive by or you're moving laterally, you somehow can't fully grasp the level of destruction. And these mining towns, which were once kind of pseudo-sovereign spaces, you know, company towns in the most profound sense, with their own security, their own everything, to see these as the mere outlines of foundations, absolutely ruined, I think is just hard to grasp if one doesn't, you know, use that technological perspective. But there's something else that is, you know, what does one do with that? I mean, this is can be in the place of the map in a certain kind of old-fashioned, an old-fashioned work. Yeah. Except, of course, it has this quality. You can also use Google Earth and so forth. But I wanted it to move. So moving across that landscape is really important, that laterality, that crossing. But also in the editing between, for example, in Below Ground Above, so you have very close-up shots of rock being ground in a way that's, in the sound in your ears is abrasive, and with the slow motion, the sound becomes incredibly monstrously slowed as well. I mean, if that works, it makes you, you know, you should feel that dust in your mouth. You should have a sensory response that allows you to ask the question of what it means to grind rock by hand that is essentially glass, because this is in quartz conglomerate. But you need to breathe too. And so this not being able to breathe with this drone shots that are effectively visual breathing, you know, to move between this compression and this expansion, if it works, that's its kind of slow rhythmic principle. So I hope I haven't just used it as a kind of substitute for the map or the, you know, the abstract introduction, those titles that appear at the beginning of so much bad documentary film, some of which I showed today in my class. I hope it has an aesthetic logic, that it gives you a sensation visually of a breathing, of an... You need a break, too. Some of it is just too much to bear.
Yeah. Well, I think just the sight of a little bit of, I'm looking at it now, oh, come rush in here, air and sky and motion does give you a certain amount of breathing space and certainly a sense of perspective that I think is very important, because one of the things that you define very, very beautifully and talk about in your work is this idea of space. You know, there's the space of the men, the miners, there's the space of a certain kind of work, there's the space of the home, and it's important to see these sort of spatial relationships that you're setting up.
It is, and I would say, I mean, the other thing that is really important is that one recognizes that those spatial logics that one might be familiar with here are not necessarily those of this world. For example, the least private place in this world is the interior of a shack. You know, when you live with five people in a shack, inside is not a private space. It is absolutely public. So sometimes it's important to actually use the camera and use the interviews and so forth to make clear that the straightforward spatial logics of interior and exterior don't yet communicate, don't mm-hmm. yet convey what is the logic, the social logic of those spaces. So those completely ruined flats, which were once houses and once office buildings, which are now the surfaces for a different kind of labor, those are also kind of weirdly, intensely social spaces. This is where women work collectively, for yeah. example. And somehow, I guess I think you need both the closer and close and medium shots and those bigger, broader vistas in order to grasp that relationship. So it is all about the relationships between those spaces.
And also, I mean, in the video in the other room, Stop Limit, mm-hmm. is you have someone who's coming in from quote-unquote the bush, and I'll ask you to talk about that, to work, it seems like, to a place where there's more human activity. And Sarah also alludes to the bush. She says, if the police evict me, get me in trouble, I'm going to go back to the bush. And the drone allows for a visual juxtaposition of the bush and the more industrial parts around the city and the city itself. But can you talk a little bit about that divide?
Yeah. There's a way in which the solitariness of that walk is pretty distorted.
Okay.
And as, you know, and it's doing a certain work, on the one hand, this is this young man, Prosper Nkuba, he is narrating his own journey, and he will, in another context, describe the entire process by which he has paid smugglers to bring him across the border. Women, they are caught, first arrested, deported, then they make their way across again. Women in their group are threatened with rape. They have to buy their way out of it. Another woman at another time also refers to these journeys through the bush as incredibly dangerous and threatening, as here, as on this border, these spaces where people are so vulnerable. And when Sarah says, you know, I'll go to the bush, I mean, this is basically saying, you know, I will kill myself. I mean, it is like the bush is a signifier of absolute wildness and madness and terror and exposure to every kind of danger. So, and yes, the structure of desire there is that you risk that crossing in order to get to the city, and in that case you pass through this glorious sunrise of Johannesburg, cross the beautiful train station, and you end up at the center, indeed what Johannesburg is built around, these mines which are now just crusts of informal settlements around the now, you know, these huge slime dams, which are actually at this very moment disappearing from the horizon of Johannesburg as they're being reclaimed for residual gold by industrial processes too. But often the kind of the proximity between these things is just extraordinary. You know, here you have this enormous mine dump and, you know, a perimeter right, you know, a row of toilets and then thousands of people residing in spaces of, you know, 6 by 8 feet and so forth. And I'm not sure what more to say, except the juxtapositions are shocking. And they are, of course, they are themselves the residue of apartheid engineering, which tried to produce spaces between whiteness and blackness, which compelled this kind of daily migrancy between township and town. And now this migrancy, alas, has not been eliminated. It has been nationalized. It has been distributed across a much broader landscape.
Well, I'm going to ask one last question, and it has to do with this, is that you were in your description in the front room, you talk about the consequences of deindustrialization. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can just be a little bit more explicit about the consequences of deindustrialization on these people's lives and maybe make a more kind of global statement about the deindustrialization.
Yeah, I think I'm starting to move toward a language of remanualization to describe this world rather than deindustrialization. And I'm sort of in that realizing that so much of what we think about when we speak about deindustrialization is the move to clean technologies, to, you know, a kind of utopic vision of what post-industrial life might be. And of course, we're living in Pennsylvania, so we know that the closures of natural resource extractive industries leave massive amounts of unemployment. It's also the case that those industries are often specific kinds of nodes, you know, towards which migrant communities gravitate. They're artificially constructed worlds in many ways. You know, there wouldn't often be, Johannesburg grew in the period of a decade from 3,000 to 100,000 people by virtue of gold. That would not be a city there otherwise. Mm. And so these artificially constructed cities, which have no reason to be, but of course assume a naturalness over the period of a century, are deeply threatened when these industries close. All mining is written into a kind of narrative of finitude. All mines will close. These mines, the calculation of the timing of closure was part of the calculation of what is called payability. So it's built into the sort of actuarial consciousness of all mining, and yet the kind of capacity to deal with what happens in that moment of closure is so limited, it would seem. In the case of these mines, we have, you know, massive toxification of the environment, we have this scarring of the world, and we also have just the disappearance of employment. So we're in this kind of now unwaged world. But what's unpayable for capital-intensive mining is not necessarily unpayable for people who have only their bodies. And in this world, you know, beyond wages, beyond industrial life, remanualization is indeed the kind of general condition of so many people who are, you know, here in Nicaragua, in Colombia. One has kind of comparable forms too, in Ghana. This reduction, once again, to a kind of absolute surplus production. What can you get out of your body if you work longer? And there's a conversation I had with a young man about, how do they calculate the length of time they will stay underground? And it's a very straightforward calculation. You will stay until you have made enough money to pay the security forces who take bribes when you enter and to pay them when you leave, because there is a small informal security. But there's a temporal calculation. It's not, you know, wages per hour, but there is stay long enough, you know, a durational dimension to this kind of investment that goes with remanualization, a return to a different calculus of time and input. And it's all about the absolute threshold. When do you have enough to live?
Yeah.
So this is a kind of absolutization that I think is part of this moment, and I think this is the future of mining in most places. This is not an aberration. Now, there are better ways of dealing with it, but the closure, the contraction, the retraction, and the residue that is remaining from all of these industrial processes, these kind of ghosts in the machine, as it were, they have to be lived with in some way that is not you know, simply fantasizing that you're going to have clean industries or tourism, which is often the answer, right?
Yeah.
So many mining towns convert themselves into museums. This kind of strange theater of the living on in a world that's no longer livable. This has become a very big thing in South Africa, but also here. It's the true of the town in which I grew up, actually, as well. But you can see, and I think someone else has maybe called into question my heavy reliance on close-ups of hands as a kind of transitional device, and that's especially true in the other documentary. And it's, I mean, it may be that I don't have enough alternative cutaways, but I wanted this to be the signifier that keeps coming back. We're back to manual life. Not just post-industrial, but re-manualized life.
And as we said on the phone when we talked last week, the one really clear view of gold is, or the best view of gold, is a ring on someone's finger.
Yeah, on that's become a still on that far wall. That, I mean, this is a strange fact, eh? That these women who are grinding rock are still wearing gold bands, are still enamored of bling, are still, they inhabit the world, the aesthetics of gold, as well as the kind of brute force of gold. You know, but you said something that just reminded me. And I shared this with Eduardo on my traveling on the train. I've been reading these essays by Emmanuel Carrère, and he tells the story of this script that he never realized. And the script is a kind of non-Marvel Comics version of a person who has the power to remain invisible or to become invisible whenever he desires. Mm. And reading this essay in this as I'm working on this project, I had this kind of shocking realization that this fantasy, that a superpower would consist in becoming invisible, absolutely only makes sense from within the comfort of visibility. That this dream of a superpower of invisibility is completely meaningless in the world, where invisibility is everyone's daily predicament. And the superpower, I suppose, if one can use that word, that people desire is the opposite, it's visibility. And I guess this is including those dimensions of the becoming aesthetic of gold.
Yeah.
This would, one would want to understand that as part of what's motivating their desire to be part of this too.
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine how much that must have cost in labor to produce that gold ring. Mm.